and I'm here with Mr. Gerald Wilson, and I'm conducting an interview at his home in Victoria at approximately 1:30 on March the 7th, 2005. Mr. Wilson, if you'd like to tell us your name and rank.
Well, good afternoon. I guess first I should introduce myself, Gerald Wilson. I'm a retired professional engineer. When I retired, I was registered in 8 provinces in Canada. And I guess you want some proof. I have here my professional engineer's card from Ontario.
Yeah.
And I also have I'm a life member in the Association of Professional Engineers, Geologists, and Geophysicists of Alberta, and a life member of the Professional Engineers and Geoscientists of BC.
Did you receive your education before or after you served in the Air Force?
Mostly after.
Mostly after. Yeah. What was your education before you enlisted into the Air Force?
Well, as we start here, you want some sort of proof. I was attending University of Alberta on a scholarship. And there's a picture, and here's another picture of my graduation as an observer in the Air Force.
When did you enlist?
I enlisted in 1942. I had started university in 1941, and was in the ROTC at university, and I guess like many, we were influenced not only by the reports in the news media and in the press about the war in England and what was going on there, but then of course the Pearl Harbor came in December, and a number of us joined up in over Christmas in 1941, and that's when I enlisted in the RCAF, and I was planning to get into air crew and hope to be a pilot. And when I had finished the initial training and they were screening for air crew positions, I was talked into being a Navigator B. So that's where I trained in the Commonwealth Air Training Plan.
Was there something about the Air Force that appealed to you more than the Army or Navy?
I guess like many young men, we thought it would be quite an interesting career. I had served while I was in public school and high school in the 49th Battalion in Edmonton. And I had a uniform issued and a bugle. I was in the bugle band. So I had a little bit of military training in the Army. And perhaps the Army might have been the first choice, except that I thought the Air Force would be a little more to my liking.
Where did your training take place?
Well, it had to take a few minutes because I trained at a number of stations. I trained as an air gunner, as a navigator, and as a bomb aimer, and a wireless operator. The year I entered in the Commonwealth Air Training Plan, they broke the trades from what it used to be in World War I, and at the beginning of World War II, they had a pilot and an observer. Those are the only two air crew trades. And the observer did the navigation, and they used the guns and did the wireless operation. And in preparation for heavy bombers, they decided they'd break the trades up. So then they trained people as bomb aimers, as navigators, as wireless operators, and air gunners. They kept one group of what they called Navigator B, and we had the old observer wing, which is what you see here where I graduated with the old wing. The intention, I guess, is we would be the second member of crews where they had two men only, such as in the Mosquito and some of the other aircraft at that time. The heavy bombers really were just getting started when we started in our initial training. So we had a whole range of training, which I found very fascinating. This is a picture of my graduation class.
What aircraft did you use for your training?
Oh, mostly the old Anson. And we had some Bolingbroke, and then initially overseas were in Whitleys and Wellingtons. When we went overseas, we had some training to familiarize us with the countryside and map reading and so on in England, and to get accustomed to facilities for flying in the UK. And then the first significant training was an operational training unit where we eventually picked up our crews. And then we did a number of flights over England with our crews. There were training flights in bombing and gunning and practice bombing, and did some fighter affiliation where we'd have mock attacks by fighter aircraft. And then the next step after that, of course, we were in crews and we went to a squadron. So the people who were at that station, they ended up usually widely dispersed at crews at various operational stations throughout Yorkshire, where the Canadian group were located. I went to a squadron first at 428, where I did my first operational flight. And while at that squadron, before we went on operation with my pilot, he went on a second dinghy trip with Sylvester's crew. It was one of the most experienced crews in the station. They were shot down. So my first pilot was killed. Then we were a headless crew, and we had a new pilot who had been a bush pilot in World War, or before the war. And at the beginning of the war, he went to the Commonwealth training plant, and he was training pilots. So he was a very experienced flyer who had done a lot of training before he was sent overseas for his bomber crew. And he was a great guy from Quebec City.
Was your crew from all over Canada?
No, mostly from the UK. Had one Irish member, and the rest were English, or there were two of us Canadians.
Oh, wow. Very mixed. So the relations were really good amongst the
different... Oh, just excellent. Yeah. Excellent. We had no discord of any kind when we were with the various people. Well, in our various stations, we had people from Jamaica, and we had people from Australia and New Zealand, and quite a few Americans were still in the Canadian Air Force. After they got overseas, most of the Americans transferred and went into the U.S. Air Force. But some stayed on the station. Some of them were on our operational stations.
So what years and where did you serve when you were over in the overseas?
Well, I was in... First, I was with the 6th Canadian Group, the number 6 group, bomber group. And I was on the, first I was on 431 and 428 squadrons, and then on 405 squadron, which is the Canadian Pathfinder squadron. While with the Canadian 6th group, I had nearly finished my first tour. When I was posted to the Pathfinder Squadron, which is the Canadian 405 Squadron. And with them, I finished my first tour, and my second, my third tour. And at the end of the war, or just before the end of the war, I was posted to a conversion unit as an instructor. And then when the war ended in Europe, I was posted to the Japanese, or to the Pacific, and I was on my way to the Pacific, halfway across Canada, when, thank God, they dropped the atomic bombs, or I probably wouldn't be here today.
So you were pretty close to home when
I was halfway across Canada way to Vancouver. I continued on to Vancouver and took my retirement there.
Oh, well done. Now, did you participate in any unique or famous operations or incidents?
Well, I guess with three tours, I covered just about every major activity in the bombing operations. I participated in the Battle of Berlin, the Battle of the Ruhr, and prior to, during, and following the Normandy invasion. I was on a number of missions. One of the most interesting, I think, trips that I was on, my crew and I were the master bombers on this raid, and I have a...
Which operation was this?
This was the Zeit synthetic oil plant, and this was published by the Illustrated London News, and it shows the attack before and after the raid. I'll give that to you. You might want to have a look at it. It shows what the site looked like before the raid and after, and it was pretty well wiped out. According to that report, a month after the raid, they still hadn't repaired it and hadn't got it back in operation.
And this took place in the Battle of the Ruhr?
No, this was after. This was late in the war. It was in February, I guess it was. But that was one of the more interesting raids because the master bomber and deputy master bomber on raids of that kind both had to be at the target first and had to circle the target throughout the raid. So we went around the target for half an hour while the various Pathfinder crews remarked the target and the main force came in and bombed according to the markings. The main force would be directed by the master bomber as to which targets to hit. When the main markers went down, oftentimes after perhaps 3 or 4 minutes, those markers would be bombed out, and either they'd be hit by bombs or there'd be so much dirt and dust and smoke and fires that you couldn't see them. So then the master bomber would call for more marking. There'd be subsequent Pathfinder markers, and they would be told where to drop their markers, and then from there the balance of the raid would carry on until the raid was finished. So in that way, you would cover, in the case of an oil refinery, which probably encompassed between 2 and 3 square miles, you would cover the whole raid, the whole field, where you had mostly storage tank. Your main aiming point would usually be the powerhouse and the main refinery. But then in addition, there'd be thousands of storage tanks for raw fuel and for finished fuel, and they were just about as important as the refinery itself. So fortunately, we got a number of those oil refineries, and the Germans were short of fuel at the end of the war, and they had difficulty fielding their aircraft and even for their tanks.
So this is a very important operation to the whole war.
Well, it was one of the factors of many. There was just no one single act in the war that was highly significant, except perhaps dropping the atomic bomb. There we proved that it was possible to stop a war with bombs. If Harris had had the force he wanted initially, he wanted enough bombers that he could put up 4,000 bomber raids, but all he got was eventually he could put up 1,000 bomber raids. So it ended up, according to the Germans, the bomber offensive against Germany was one of the most significant factors in the defeat of Germany, according to the Germans. We never seem to hear that from today's reporters or from people in the Army or Navy. But I think the important point is that it was a combined effort, and no one group was more effective than the others. Poor devils who were on the Atlantic shipping were one of the most significant groups above ever because they were necessary for supplying all of Europe. That really wasn't recognized until a few years ago. now I think they get full credit for what they did.
They do. Now, with regards to your flights that you would take as a Pathfinder, do you meet a lot of resistance, like anti-aircraft and enemy fighters?
Well, I thought you had that. You had to face that all the way into a target and out of the target and over the target. It'd be a combination of fighters and flak. I guess fighters shot down more aircraft than the anti-aircraft did. One of the strategic effects of the bomber offensive, which is seldom mentioned, was the fact that Germany could be reached anywhere by bomber command, and as a result they had defensive crews around nearly every major city and center in Germany, and that meant that there were over 1 million servicemen and their anti-aircraft equipment stationed throughout Germany who otherwise would have been hitting the Russians or hitting the Allies in France or earlier in North Africa and through Italy. So that, as a strategic factor, was a significant factor in itself.
Very significant. So Germany basically had to pull a lot of resources into defending itself from...
They had a lot of people diverted into both protection of their cities and a change in their tactics. They had to go to a defensive action instead of offensive, so that meant they had to build fighter aircraft for defenses instead of having offensive aircraft for mainly, at that time, the Russians. But then, of course, they had their V-1 buzz bombs and then the V-2 rockets. If they'd had more resources, these weapons would have been much more effective than they were. But they still killed a few thousand people.
How long would one of your Pathfinder missions last for?
Well, the longest one, if we went on a major raid to a city like Berlin or Stettin or Nuremberg, it'd be between 7.5 and up to 9 hours. So it depended on the route that you took. Oftentimes, in efforts to avoid flak and known fighter aircraft, we had diverted raid, so you sometimes had a long way around. But a couple of times we went over Sweden, and that was interesting because we saw lights. We'd never seen lights in the UK or over Germany.
How long would a tank of gas last then? For fuel, I mean, in the aircraft?
Well, we'd run out after about 9 or 10 hours, so that there was a limited...
Did you ever have to make a landing where you were gliding in?
No, we came back short of our home base on a number of occasions, but not because of fuel shortage, because we'd lost an engine. And when you lose an engine, you burn more fuel to keep up, and you end up having to be diverted. So we did come down a few times with three engines. Thank goodness we had the three engines.
What was the main German aircraft you'd be up against when you were in the air?
Well, I guess the Focke-Wulf 190 and the Messerschmitt would be the main fighters.
Yeah. Was the Messerschmitt a good fighter?
Excellent, yes.
Yeah. How would our fighters hold up against the German fighters?
Well, you'd have to talk to a fighter pilot. They couldn't really comment very much.
Yeah.
They were both pretty effective.
Yeah.
And they both shot down bombers on both sides. The Americans didn't penetrate very deep into Germany until later in the war because the German fighters were so effective. And until the Americans could send their own fighter aircraft as protection, they had very heavy losses. So the 8th Air Force flew daylights, we flew nighttime. And they finally got their Mustangs equipped with fuel tanks that they ejected, so they had enough fuel to penetrate deep into Germany and escort the American bombers into deep raids. But initially, they didn't go in very far. We came down one time. When we were diverted, we had lost an engine, and we were diverted to an American Liberator drone. And we had to be debriefed at the American station. And we were returning from a trip to Berlin, and they had never been to Berlin, so they treated us like, they gave us the gold treatment for sure. And it was very, they were very hospitable, I think. They showed us pictures they had taken of some of their operations, where they had movies taken of German fighters attacking and of their own squadrons flying. It was a very interesting time.
They opened up their arms to you?
Oh, they were just, the hospitality was overwhelming.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great to hear. I mean, so the relations were excellent
amongst
everybody.
Yeah, all the air crew got along very well.
Is it like a fraternity? The air crews all over?
Almost, you would say so, yes.
I mean, I've heard stories about German, the German Air Force at the time, Luftwaffe, they would, when we had down fighter pilots, they would make sure the fighter pilots weren't in the concentration camps.
Yeah, I understand. They treated them fairly well. Excuse me, I'll get the... Prior to it and following it, and I was on the... participated in the Berlin raids and in the Battle of the Ruhr, and nearly every other major center in Germany. So it was a very interesting time. I was extremely lucky, actually. Three tours, I should be dead.
Were you with the same squadron all three tours?
No, I had three different squadrons.
Three different squadrons.
I was in 4th First, we lost my first pilot, and I was in 4th Main Force. And then I was in 405, which is the Pathfinder squadron.
Were there any others with you that made it through three tours, do you know of?
The only three people that seem very well known in Canada are Johnny Fauquier, who is a wing commander and squadron leader, and Reg Lane, who is Victoria, who was CO of 405 squadron, and he finished his third tour shortly before I got to the squadron, and Bill Newsom, whose family were also from Victoria, and he did three tours. His first tour was on Coastal Command, and he did one tour on 4th Squadron on the Main Force, Canadian 6th Group, and then he did his third tour with the Pathfinders. And they're the only three I know that did three tours.
Did you have any close calls while you were in the air that you thought you were going to be going down and over Europe, right?
Well, I was never... I had the Perspex knocked out one time, but other than that, the only close call I think we had was with flying in a Halifax with Frank Gilliland, who was the pilot who was from Quebec and who was a very good pilot. We were coned on the way home from a trip and not far from the Ruhr. And often, if an aircraft was coned, they were shot down because you'd then be the center of visual sighting for the PACAC, and sometimes they coned an aircraft and the fighters then would zero in on it. Now we were heading home, so we would have been flying generally in a northwesterly direction. And when we were coned, the usual practice would be to dive and try and get enough speed and then pull out of the cone. Frank very courageously and quickly did a diving turn, and he turned back and was heading back into Germany. And the searchlight crews, I presume, were anticipated we'd be continuing to England. So we got out of the cone. And not only that, but of course we had a great deal of speed then, and fortunately the aircraft held together when he pulled it out. So that was about one of the closest calls I think I ever had. Anytime we lost an engine, you're always pretty pretty nervous because you never knew what was going to happen next. And if one engine was knocked out, there was always a chance that something else was hit. So those are the only really close calls I had, I guess.
Would you have support fighter groups when you were going back home, heading home?
No, I didn't.
No. They just take you in and then...
Towards the end of the war, we had a few daylight raids. Most of our flying was at night, even at the end of the war, but we had a few daylight raids. And when we did, we would have fighter escorts, so they would be, you would see them, usually they'd be very high and available for some assistance if you needed it.
How would your aircraft generally hold up during the raids? Pretty good?
Well, the old Wellington, of course, was a two-engine bomber, and it was a wood and fabric aircraft, and it had a geodetic construction. They held up very well, even when they were hit badly. The other aircraft, if they were badly hit, usually that would be the end of it. Sometimes they'd come back, you'd see an aircraft with a tail half shot off or parts of the damage, but not too many got back after they were hit.
Did you find your training really prepared you well for when you went into on your missions?
I think as well as one could be trained. You had a job to do and were taught how to do it. I don't think there was much more training one could have. A pilot had to learn to fly. Each member of the crew had to do his job. The navigator, the gunner, and so on. The bomb aimer just had to drop the bombs. Wasn't all that difficult. We had practice. There were simulated bombing units on most of the stations, so that we could carry out some practice bombing in the simulator.
Do you think your the missions that you flew were very important to maintain air supremacy over Europe, like after the invasion of D-Day?
Well, I guess the Americans, with their daylight operation, probably attracted more German fighters that were shot down than the Canadian or the British bomber group. At night, and with only a 303 gun, we weren't as effective in shooting down enemy aircraft as the American. Their Flying Fortress and their Liberators just bristled with guns. And they were .5, so they had pretty heavy armament. And were a much more formidable group to attack for the Germans than the Canadians. And the tactics were different, of course. They would attempt to find a lone aircraft and get under it and attack it. So unseen, so that oftentimes you wouldn't know an aircraft was attacking.
What other besides the oil refinery that you bombed? What other types of would you be bombing, like ammunition factories or other air bases?
Well, every industrial center in Germany was involved in some kind of wartime activity.
Yeah.
So that we hear people complaining today about Dresden having been bombed. The facts are that Dresden had numerous war factories in operation at the time, and they were supplying a whole range of equipment used for submarines and aircraft and armies. So that even Dresden, which many writers today make great excuses and say that it should never be bombed. I'd be more interested in the comments of some poor devil in a concentration camp in those views, because every day that the war was shortened, a lot of people's lives were saved. So that anything that shortened the war was game and should be carried out. And during this whole time, the Germans were still dropping V-2s on London and cities in Europe and in England. And they were still raiding the coast with raiding aircraft. So the war was going on, and despite the fact that many people predicted the war was nearing an end, and as it was, that really wasn't a time to slack off. As we all know, the Ardennes offensive of the Germans could very well have been much more damaging than it was. As it was, it delayed the end of the war by some weeks or months.
The factor that
so they the Germans weren't defeated until really the end. And anything could be done to knock them out was well worth doing.
And taking note, this oil, the oil factory that you guys did is an important part of doing that.
Well, a lot of oil refineries were hit.
Yeah.
I was on a number of other raids where the principal target was an oil refinery or a city that had oil refining capability. That was just part of the operation. One of the most heavily defended areas in Germany, outside of Berlin, which I guess is the most heavily protected by the Germans, was the Ruhr. And Essen was where they had the big German armament factory, the Krupps-Werks. They had steel and other heavy manufacturing going on there. And that was one of the toughest targets. But nearly every significant center in Germany had a lot of war factory operation going on. So there hardly was a target in Germany that really wasn't involved in the war effort.
Did you ever...
That's no excuse for war. It's a shame we had a war. But the real shame should be the politicians who let it happen. We didn't have enough defenses. None of the Allies had enough defense. France is probably as guilty as a lot of other politicians because the French had the strongest army in Europe in the 1930s when they should have and could have stopped Germany under the treaty in World War I. And they didn't.
Yeah.
And they were so politically, what would we say, divided in the country.
Very unstable in France.
Yeah. And they did nothing to stop the Germans. They could. They had a very big army. They had lots of ability to have done something, but they didn't.
So do you feel
you... It hadn't been much help to you. But
oh, no. You've been great help. It's great. Interview. Now, so you feel you're a very lucky individual?
Extremely
lucky. Three
extremely
tours.
Extremely lucky, yeah.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for this interview.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.